A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching the Iran-UDOT negotiations through Pakistan, and he noticed something in the language. Iran's denying new statements, claiming a memorandum of understanding will be signed tomorrow. And the question is basically, what even is an MOU in diplomacy? He says they sound like one step up from a gentleman's agreement, or the warm-up act before a real deal. What role do they actually play? How does their usage differ between diplomatic and governmental contexts? And why might this particular agreement be structured as an MOU, rather than a formal peace agreement?
This is one of those questions where the answer reveals way more than the question even asks. Because the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding, it's simultaneously the most misunderstood and most strategically useful instrument in the diplomatic toolkit. And the Iran situation right now is basically a masterclass in why.
Let's start with the basic taxonomy. What actually is an MOU, legally speaking? Because I think most people hear Memorandum of Understanding and immediately think it's diplomatic for we had a nice chat and wrote some things down.
That's not wrong exactly, but it undersells what's happening. In international law, an MOU is a non-legally binding agreement between two or more parties. The key phrase there is non-legally binding. It's not a treaty. It doesn't create enforceable obligations under international law. But, and this is the part people miss, it's not nothing either. It creates political commitments. It sets expectations. It establishes a framework that, if one party violates it, carries real diplomatic consequences even if it doesn't carry legal ones.
It's binding in the court of reputation, but not the International Court of Justice.
And in diplomacy, reputation is often the more powerful court. The classic definition comes from the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, which distinguishes between treaties, which are legally binding, and what it calls political commitments, which is where MOUs live. The United Nations Treaty Handbook, I was looking at this, explicitly says MOUs are used when the parties want to avoid creating legal obligations but still want something formal enough to point to.
That sounds like a contradiction. Why would you want to avoid creating legal obligations?
About a dozen reasons, and they all apply to the Iran situation. A treaty typically requires ratification. In the UK case, that means two-thirds of the Senate. An MOU doesn't. The executive branch can do it on its own authority. You can amend an MOU without going through the whole treaty process. Third, and this is crucial for Iran, an MOU lets both sides claim victory without actually locking themselves into anything irreversible.
It's the diplomatic equivalent of, let's see how this goes.
And with Iran, that's the whole game. The reporting from ABC Australia this morning, they've got a piece up saying Iran's foreign ministry is calling this the closest they've ever been to peace with the United States, but also denying that anything's been signed. The denial itself is part of the negotiation. They're signaling to their domestic audience, to hardliners in Tehran, that they haven't capitulated, while simultaneously signaling to the international community that they're serious.
Of course they are, because signing an MOU lets you say two completely contradictory things at once. To the international community, look, we've made a commitment. To your domestic critics, it's not legally binding. Calm down.
That's not a bug. That's the feature. The ambiguity is the point. I saw the Euronews piece from yesterday. Trump is publicly warning Tehran to get their act together, which is classic negotiating theater, while behind the scenes, Pakistan is mediating what appears to be a very detailed MOU framework. The public rhetoric and the private document serve completely different audiences.
Let's talk about that difference between diplomatic MOUs and governmental ones. Because the prompt specifically asks about that distinction, and I think it's important. When the Department of Defense signs an MOU with the Department of Energy about sharing nuclear materials data, that's a very different animal than the UN-Iran signing an MOU about nuclear inspections.
Domestic governmental MOUs, interagency agreements, those are often practically binding even if not legally binding. They're governed by things like the Economy Act in the EU, which gives them statutory backing. An MOU between the EPA and the Department of Agriculture about water quality monitoring. That's going to have funding attached, staff assigned, congressional reporting requirements. It's not a treaty, but it's backed by the machinery of government in a way that an international MOU isn't.
The domestic version has teeth because the same sovereign power backs both parties. The international version has teeth only to the extent that both parties care about their reputation and the relationship.
And that's why international MOUs live or die on verification mechanisms. If there's no way to check whether the other side is complying, the MOU is worth less than the paper it's printed on. Which brings us back to Iran. Any MOU here is going to be absolutely loaded with inspection protocols, verification timelines, third-party monitoring, because without those, it's just a press release.
That's where Pakistan's mediator gets interesting. They're not just passing notes. They're presumably going to be involved in some kind of verification role, or at least a witness role that adds weight to the political commitment.
Pakistan's position here is fascinating. They've managed to position themselves as the indispensable middleman between Washington and Tehran, which is a remarkable diplomatic achievement given that they're also balancing relationships with China and Saudi Arabia. The mediation gives them regional prestige without requiring them to actually take sides on the substance.
The professional bridesmaid of geopolitics.
Loving every minute of it. But to get back to the core question, the MOU as a form, there's actually a pretty well-established hierarchy in diplomatic instruments. At the bottom, you've got the joint statement, which is basically, we met, we talked, we agree the sky is blue. Then you've got the memorandum of understanding, which says, we have a shared framework and specific intentions. Above that, you've got the executive agreement, which in EU practice carries more weight and sometimes domestic legal force. And at the top, you've got the treaty, which is legally binding under international law and typically requires legislative ratification.
Where does the gentleman's agreement fit? Because that's how the prompt framed it. One step up from that.
A gentleman's agreement is even lower than a joint statement. It's unwritten, unacknowledged, purely based on personal trust between the individuals involved. The MOU is far more formal. It's a written document. It's usually published or at least officially acknowledged. It has specific provisions, timelines, often dispute resolution mechanisms. It's not a gentleman's agreement. It's more like a prenuptial agreement that you're not legally required to honor, but that everyone knows you'll look terrible if you break.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure that.
You're not legally obligated to feed it, but everyone's gonna judge you if you don't.
Actually, not a bad analogy. The MOU creates expectations. It creates a standard against which your behavior will be measured. You can technically walk away at any time, but doing so carries a cost. And in diplomacy, that cost can be quite high. Loss of credibility, loss of future negotiating partners, loss of leverage in other negotiations.
Why not just sign a treaty? If both sides are serious, why did the MOU dance at all?
Several reasons, and they're all in play with Iran. First, the U.S. Senate is not going to ratify a treaty with Iran, it's just not. The political math doesn't work. So the executive branch has two choices. Do nothing, or use instruments that don't require Senate approval. The MOU is one of those instruments.
On the Iranian side?
Iran's constitutional structure is complicated in ways that make treaty ratification genuinely difficult. The supreme leader has ultimate authority, but the parliament and the guardian council both have roles. An MOU can potentially be handled at the executive level, the foreign ministry, or the Supreme National Security Council, without going through the full constitutional treaty process. That's attractive to both sides for different reasons.
It's also deniable in ways a treaty isn't. If the political winds shift in Tehran, or Washington for that matter, an MOU can be quietly abandoned without the formal abrogation process that a treaty requires.
That's not theoretical. We saw exactly this with the JCPOA, the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. That was structured as a political commitment, not a legally binding treaty, precisely because the Obama administration knew it couldn't get through the Senate. When Trump pulled out in 2018, he could do so unilaterally because it wasn't a treaty. If it had been a treaty, withdrawal would have required Senate approval.
The JCPOA was effectively an MOU with extra steps.
It was a very elaborate MOU with a Security Council resolution wrapped around it for extra weight. But legally, yes, it was a non-binding political commitment. And that's why the current negotiations are so interesting. They're essentially trying to reconstruct something like the JCPOA, but with different parameters, different verification mechanisms, and a very different regional context.
The regional context has shifted enormously. The Abraham Accords happened. Iran's proxy network has been degraded. Saudi-Israeli normalization is still on the table, sort of. The whole board looks different.
That's another reason for using an MOU. When the strategic environment is fluid, you don't want to lock yourself into a rigid treaty framework that'll take years to renegotiate if circumstances change. An MOU gives you flexibility. You can adjust, you can reinterpret, you can walk away with less legal entanglement.
What about the trade context, though? The prompt mentions MOUs being common in major trade contracts, and that's a whole different usage pattern. In business, an MOU often precedes a definitive agreement. It's the "we agree in principle" document that kicks off due diligence.
Right. And this is where the terminology gets confusing because the same words mean different things in different contexts. In commercial law, an MOU can be legally binding or non-binding depending on how it's drafted and the intent of the parties. Courts will look at the language, the context, whether there was consideration exchanged. A commercial MOU that says the parties agree to negotiate in good faith toward a definitive agreement, that can actually create enforceable obligations in some jurisdictions.
Whereas in diplomacy, we agree to negotiate in good faith is basically decorative text.
Diplomatic language is deliberately porous in ways that commercial language tries very hard not to be. A corporate lawyer drafting an MOU will agonize over every shall versus will versus may because those words have specific legal consequences. A diplomat drafting an MOU is often trying to create precisely enough ambiguity that both sides can live with the text.
The creative ambiguity doctrine. We want this to mean different things to different audiences.
Henry Kissinger basically built a career on that. The classic example is the Shanghai Communique of 1972 with China, where both sides essentially agreed to disagree about Taiwan, but used language ambiguous enough that each could claim the document supported their position. That wasn't a bug in the drafting, it was the entire point.
What would an Iran UMOU actually contain, if you had to guess based on what's been reported?
Based on the reporting, there are a few things we can be fairly confident about. Nuclear inspections and enrichment limits are almost certainly the core. The ABC piece mentions that the framework includes verification mechanisms that go beyond what the JCPOA had, which makes sense given that the JCPOA's verification failures were one of the main criticisms from opponents. There's probably something about sanctions relief, likely phased, tied to compliance milestones. And there's almost certainly language about Iran's ballistic missile program and its support for regional proxies, though those are probably the most heavily negotiated and most ambiguous sections.
The missile piece is interesting because that was the big criticism of the JCPOA from the right. It didn't address missiles at all, and it had sunset clauses on enrichment limits. An MOU that addresses missiles, even in ambiguous language, would be a significant expansion of scope.
An MOU is actually the perfect vehicle for that expansion precisely because it's non-binding. Iran can accept language about missiles in a non-binding document that it would never accept in a treaty because the domestic political cost is lower. The Supreme Leader can say to the Revolutionary Guard, "This doesn't legally constrain us, it's just a political understanding." Meanwhile, the U can say to its allies, "Look, we got missile language in there."
Everybody gets to claim they won.
Which is how you know it might actually work. The best diplomatic agreements are the ones where both sides can sell them as victories to their domestic constituencies.
There's a cynical read here, though, which is that MOUs are basically diplomatic theater. They're what you do when you want to look like you're doing something without actually doing anything. Is that unfair?
It's partly unfair and partly accurate. There are definitely MOUs that are pure signaling. Signed at summits, full of lofty language, never implemented, forgotten within months. The State Department probably has filing cabinets full of them. But there are also MOUs that have changed the strategic landscape. The 1994 agreed framework with North Korea was technically an MOU-like political commitment, and while it ultimately collapsed, it did freeze North Korea's plutonium production for nearly a decade. That's not nothing.
It depends on the verification mechanisms and the political will behind it.
the consequences for non-compliance. The weakness of an MOU isn't that it's non-binding, it's that the only enforcement mechanism is reputational. If the violating party doesn't care about its reputation, or if the other parties aren't willing to impose consequences, the MOU is worthless. With North Korea, when they violated the agreed framework, the consequences were not much, ultimately. With Iran, the question is whether the international community would actually snap back sanctions or impose other costs if Iran violated an MOU.
That's where the Trump administration's approach gets interesting, because they've shown a willingness to impose costs unilaterally that the Obama administration was much more reluctant about. The maximum pressure campaign was controversial, but it did change Iran's calculus.
It also changed the credibility of EU commitments in the other direction. Part of why Iran wants an MOU rather than a treaty is precisely because they don't trust that a future EU administration won't just tear it up, the way Trump tore up the JCPOA. An MOU is easier to walk away from, but it's also easier for the other side to walk away from. It's a mutual low-commitment structure.
Mutually assured non-commitment.
That's actually a pretty good way to put it. And in a relationship as deeply mistrustful as the EU-Iran relationship, that might be the only structure that works. A treaty would require levels of trust and domestic political capital that simply don't exist on either side.
Let's talk about Pakistan's role more specifically. They're not just hosting talks. The reporting says they're the formal mediator, and the MOU would be signed in Islamabad, or at least announced from there. What does it mean for a third country to mediate an MOU?
Mediation adds a layer of political commitment without adding legal obligation. Pakistan isn't guaranteeing the agreement. They're not co-signing in a way that makes them responsible for enforcement. But their involvement as mediator creates a kind of moral witness function. If Iran violates the MOU, they're not just violating an understanding with the EU, they're embarrassing Pakistan, which stuck its neck out to broker the deal.
Pakistan has its own reasons to want this to succeed. Regional stability, reducing the risk of a conflict that could spill over into their territory. Demonstrating diplomatic relevance independent of China.
Pakistan is desperate for foreign investment and trade. Being seen as the country that brokered EU-Iran de-escalation is enormously valuable for their international brand. It's the kind of soft power that translates into hard economic benefits over time.
The MOU structure serves Pakistan's interests too. It's lower stakes than a treaty, which means less reputational damage if it falls apart, but enough of an achievement to claim credit if it holds.
And it's worth noting that Pakistan has actually been in the mediation business for a while with these two countries. They've been passing messages between Washington and Tehran for years, partly because they share a border with Iran and have a direct interest in stability. The MOU format just makes that role more formal and visible.
What about the domestic legal status of an MOU in the EU? You mentioned the executive can do it without Congress, but are there limits?
There are limits, but they're political rather than legal. The State Department has internal procedures for what counts as an international agreement that triggers certain reporting requirements. Under the case Zablocki Act, the Secretary of State is supposed to transmit the text of any international agreement, including non-binding ones, to Congress within 60 days. But that's a reporting requirement, not an approval requirement. Congress can't veto an MOU. They can hold hearings, they can make noise, they can pass resolutions of disapproval, but the executive branch retains the authority to enter into non-binding political commitments on its own.
Congress could theoretically pass legislation that blocks funding for implementation, but they can't stop the MOU itself.
And that's the real check, not on the agreement itself, but on the resources needed to carry it out. If an MOU requires sanctions relief, Congress could refuse to lift sanctions. If it requires funding for inspections, Congress could refuse to appropriate, so the executive branch still has to manage the politics, even if it doesn't need a formal vote.
Which is probably why the Trump administration is doing this now rather than, say, in an election year. They've got political capital to spend.
They're spending it on an instrument that, if it fails, fails quietly. An MOU that collapses doesn't generate the same headlines as a treaty that's voted down. It's a lower-risk diplomatic play.
The prompt also asked about the difference between MOUs in governmental versus diplomatic contexts, and we touched on that with interagency agreements. But I want to go deeper on one aspect. Governmental MOUs often involve money, actual budget transfers, resource commitments. Diplomatic MOUs almost never do. They're about behavior, not funding.
That's a really important distinction. A domestic interagency MOU will typically specify exactly who pays for what, which personnel are detailed to which project, what the reporting structure is. It's operational. A diplomatic MOU is strategic. It sets out principles, commitments, timelines for further negotiation. It's a framework document, not an operational plan.
When the Department of Interior signs an MOU with the Forest Service about wildfire coordination, that's basically a work order. When the EU signs an MOU with Iran about nuclear enrichment, that's basically a shared wish list with some verification attached.
With the crucial difference being that the domestic MOU is backed by the same sovereign. If there's a dispute, it gets resolved within the same legal and administrative system. The international MOU exists in a space where there's no higher authority to appeal to. It's just the parties and whatever leverage they can bring to bear.
The anarchy of the international system, reduced to a 2-page document with memorandum of understanding at the top.
And that's actually why the language of international MOUs is so carefully calibrated. Every word is negotiated because there's no court to interpret ambiguities. If the text says, the parties intend to, versus the parties shall, that difference matters enormously because it's the only thing anyone can point to later.
Let's talk about the actual text craft. What are the hallmarks of a well-drafted diplomatic MOU versus a bad one?
A good diplomatic MOU does a few things. 1. It's specific enough to create real expectations, but vague enough to allow political flexibility. 2. It includes clear verification or review mechanisms, regular meetings, reporting requirements, inspection protocols. 3. It has an exit clause that's clear but not too easy to trigger. 4. It avoids language that could be interpreted as creating legal obligations. You'll see phrases like, the participants express their intention to, rather than the parties agree to.
A bad one?
A bad MOU is either so vague it's meaningless. The parties reaffirm their commitment to peace and stability in the region, with no specifics, or so detailed that it becomes a treaty in all but name, which defeats the purpose and creates expectations it can't fulfill. The worst MOUs are the ones that try to have it both ways, specific enough to create disappointment when they're not implemented, but not specific enough to create accountability.
The mushy middle of diplomatic failure.
There are a lot of those. The diplomatic archives are full of MOUs that were signed with great fanfare and then quietly ignored. The test is always implementation. Did anything actually change after the signing ceremony?
Which brings us back to Iran. What would actually changing look like here?
If this MOU is real, we should see several things fairly quickly. IAEA inspectors getting access to sites they've been denied. Tangible steps on enrichment limits. Actual reduction in stockpiles, not just promises. Movement on American detainees in Iran. Some kind of sanctions relief that's concrete enough to affect Iran's economy. If none of those things happen within, say, 6 months, then the MOU was theater.
The denial from Iran today, saying no MOU will be signed tomorrow. That could be pre-spin, or it could be a genuine last-minute hiccup.
Or it could be both. The fact that they're denying it publicly while the U.S. saying it's imminent is actually pretty standard for this stage of negotiations. Each side is managing expectations with their domestic audience. Iran doesn't want to look eager, doesn't want to look like it's being strung along. The denials and the leaks are part of the same dance.
The negotiation doesn't stop when the document is drafted. It continues through the announcement strategy.
Through the implementation. Every step of an MOU is negotiated. The signing, the announcement, the interpretation, the verification. It's not a single event. It's an ongoing process where the document is just a reference point.
If someone's reading the news and sees MOU to be signed and thinks, oh, they worked it out, they're misunderstanding what an MOU actually represents.
The MOU isn't the resolution. It's the agreement to keep talking within a structured framework. It's a milestone, not a destination. And with U-Iran relations, there is no destination. There's just the next milestone.
That's a pretty sobering way to look at it.
It's realistic. The relationship is too fraught, the history too complicated, the interests too divergent for any single agreement to resolve everything. The best you can hope for is a series of incremental understandings that reduce the risk of conflict and create space for broader normalization over time. The MOU is the right instrument for that because it matches the reality. Tentative, reversible, but potentially meaningful if both sides stay committed.
What about the international law angle? We've talked about MOUs being non-binding, but is there any scenario where an MOU could be interpreted as creating legal obligations despite the intent?
There's actually a fascinating body of scholarship on this. The International Court of Justice has occasionally found that what were called MOUs, or political commitments, actually created legal obligations based on the specific language and circumstances. The key case is Qatar v. Bahrain from 1994, where the ICJ found that minutes of a meeting, basically an MOU-level document, constituted a legally binding agreement because of the specific wording and the context in which it was signed.
The label doesn't always control.
The label is evidence of intent, but it's not dispositive. Courts will look at the actual language, the circumstances of signing, the subsequent conduct of the parties. If you call something an MOU, but then say, the parties hereby undertake a legally binding obligation to, that's going to be treated as binding regardless of what you called it.
Which is why the drafting is so careful. You avoid words like undertake, obligation, shall, agree. You use intend, expect, will seek to, express their shared desire to.
The whole document becomes an exercise in avoiding commitment while sounding committed. It's a unique genre of writing. Diplomatic language and MOUs is basically the opposite of what they teach you in law school. In law school, they teach you to be precise, to eliminate ambiguity. In diplomatic MOU drafting, ambiguity is the product.
The glockenspiel of international relations.
I'm not sure I follow.
It sounds serious and official, but nobody's quite sure what note it's actually hitting.
The MOU is the glockenspiel of diplomacy. It's in the orchestra, it's making noise, everyone can hear it, but nobody can quite tell you what melody it's playing.
To pull this together, the MOU is not a gentleman's agreement. It's more formal, more structured, more public. But it's also not a treaty. It occupies this middle space where political commitment exists without legal obligation. In domestic governmental contexts, it's often backed by statutory authority and funding, which gives it practical teeth. In international diplomacy, its only real backing is reputation and the consequences the parties are willing to impose for non-compliance.
For Iran and the EU, it's probably the only viable format right now. A treaty can't pass the Senate. A less formal understanding wouldn't provide enough structure for verification. The MOU threads the needle. Enough substance to be meaningful. Enough flexibility to be politically survivable on both sides.
The question is whether both sides actually want it to survive, or whether they just want to be seen as the one who tried.
That's the question that'll be answered in the implementation, or not answered. MOUs have a way of leaving questions hanging indefinitely.
Which is, again, probably the point. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, British Somaliland exported roughly 1,000 tons of myrrh annually. For comparison, that is the weight equivalent of about 167 fully grown African elephants, or enough aromatic resin to fill a modern 20-foot shipping container every 3 days for a year.
A shipping container of myrrh.
Every 3 days. That's a lot of wise men. Here's the forward-looking question. If this MOU gets signed, or doesn't, what's the thing to watch that'll tell you whether it's real or theater?
If inspectors are on the ground at undeclared sites within 90 days, the MOU has substance. If they're still negotiating access 6 months from now, it was a press release with extra steps.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've got a question you want us to dig into, send it through the website.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.